Hi, I'm Kieran O'Donnell. Welcome to Business Matters. For this week's podcast, I spoke to International Fund for Ireland Chairman, Paddy Hart. The International Fund for Ireland was established as an independent organisation in 1986 by the Irish and British governments, with a focus on promoting economic and social ties between unionists and nationalists in Northern Ireland and in the border counties of Donegal, Sligo, Leitrim, Louth, Monaghan and Cavan. To date, it has invested €914 million in some 6,000 projects. As Paddy acknowledged, it's been a challenging 18 months for the fund since he took on the role as chairman back in March 2019. Paddy, you were appointed as chairman of the International Fund for Ireland back in March 2019. It's been quite an eventful year and quite an eventful year and a half.
Yes, it has, Kieran. I'd been on the board for 4 years beforehand. It was the turn of a southern member of the board to go on the chair, and I was asked what I consider it, and eventually was appointed by both governments. For the first 4 years, it was a fairly straightforward board membership, hard work, and then when I came into chair, lots of things started. Brexit started to take on the shape that we're beginning to see now. We had some tensions in Derry with Liara McKee in particular, and that triggered a lot of other tension for quite some time. Not very much was happening, and we had all in this part of the world had come to take for granted that things were pretty normal. As I say, Brexit appeared. There was a bombing in Derry, and not long after, the murder of Liara McKee, and that caused tensions in Belfast, and all of a sudden, the picture that was very clear began to become unclear, and then we find ourselves in a pandemic, and that has its own challenges, apart from all of the obvious ones that all of us are experiencing, and I'm saying that, and I'm in Donegal, which is, if you're going to be in a pandemic, it's a great place to be. So I'm thinking more of people who maybe aren't in as good a place as this. But notwithstanding all of that, it's also caused lots of problems that you would not have ever anticipated.
Go back to your early days with the AFA.
Yeah, a long time ago. The AFA was set up in 1986 after the Anglo-Irish Agreement. It was the only cross-border body in existence at all, except for the Foyle Fisheries Commission. So that's just to remind people, all the cross-border stuff that's going on now, none of it existed. So this was a really exciting organisation to get involved in. It had an awful lot of money, and also there wasn't very much public money around. So it played a major role in changing the economic status of lots of very disadvantaged places in Northern Ireland that had been affected badly by the Troubles, and in the southern border counties, including Donegal. And I was delighted to represent it for Donegal for as long as I did. It was a fabulous job. You meet fabulous people where you sat down one day and you started to talk about what you might do for their town or village. And over a period of 4 to 5 years, you would see just the amount of talent and energy and passion that people in local communities have to turn their villages and towns around. And that was a great privilege and honour to work in that.
In recent figures, €914 million spent on something like 6,000 projects over that time.
Yeah, when you put it that way, it was quite significant. When I look back at some of the things that have happened, and you can go around Donegal and you can see them all, and now they're all doing their own thing, and they're way beyond the very important money that the AFA gave them, but they've taken that money and they've turned it into multiple versions of that money. So really significant money at the time, and made a really significant impact that is still there, and it's there in ways that go way beyond the money. The money is probably the attraction, but once that trigger's there, the passion and energy that it releases is just great to be part of it.
Any one project that stands out locally or across the board?
Oh, the list goes on. I mean, I can't pass Strabane and Lifford because I'm home, roots in Lifford, and my wife's home roots are in Strabane. I mean, when you look now, there's no Camel's Hump, there's no British Army checkpoint, there are no paramilitary checkpoints on either side of that. You can walk around Stabban now. It's suffered a lot, and it'll never be the, and I certainly don't think in my life, be the fabulous town that it was before the Troubles. But I like to think that the focus that the International Fund gave to Stabban and Lafford, that was so traumatised, and you can now you go across and you don't know the borders there. And that's probably, if I'm picking something out, that's probably it.
You said shortly after your appointment that the communities were the great unsung heroes of the Northern Ireland peace process.
I believe that entirely. Jonathan Powell, Tony Blair's advisor, said that the unsung hero of the Good Friday Agreement was not a person, it was a fund, referring to the International Fund. But I'd remarked to him subsequent to that the International Fund wasn't the unsung hero. The unsung hero were the communities. I know we all remember the Troubles, but if you can get yourself back into what it was like, say, in Stabban, it was a place that's nearest to us, or Derry. I mean, it was pretty dark, pretty black, and there wasn't anybody doing anything. And behind the scenes, quietly, you had community, if you like, leaders who didn't want to be known as leaders, who were taking massive risks when sometimes their own life at risk to move things on. And I've said it before that if it had not been for that work which communities were doing, AFI helped to fund them, but it was the communities and individuals in the communities that were doing that work. I don't think you would have found all of the people who went to the table, the Good Friday Agreement would have been there, because the communities eventually got strong enough to say, sorry, we don't really want this anymore. So I think they are the unsung heroes of the peace process, of the Good Friday Agreement, and lots of other things in life.
So it was 12 years after the AFA got up and run that the Good Friday Agreement came into being. That 12 years, you feel, was a huge stepping stone in getting where we are now?
I think so. Just as we said at the beginning, at the beginning of the AFA, there were no cross-border bodies. None. Now, you had sort of relationships between Donegal County Council and Derry Council, roads and stuff, but no bodies. So the AFA set up cross-border panels, for want of a better word. And with those panels, it did was that it had business people and public servants all sitting down with neutral money that was from overseas. So they were able to make neutral decisions. So you didn't have people from Northern Ireland looking after the Northern Ireland budget, or people from the Republic of Ireland looking after the Republic of Ireland budget. So they started to work together, and they'd never worked together before. So over that 12 years, you had civil servants, public servants, business people working together in ways that they'd never worked before. So whenever it got to cross-border bodies, then lots of these people had been working together for 12 years, quietly in the background. So that's a part of the AFA is not that well known. Also, in communities where whenever the violence erupted in the first instance, people really didn't know what hit them. So by the time they got themselves organised, they were beginning to get the confidence. The AFA was helped support them, but it was they who did it. And I think that they changed the political landscape in a way that everyone who was at the table was there in decent measure because of the work of communities and because of the support that the AFA gave them.
We're in a post-Brexit era. How do you see things unfolding?
I'm an optimist. I'm struggling to remain the optimist that I was, but I do know that that there'll be a lot more important things in life to deal with than Brexit. It can get overblown, you know. So I try to keep it in context. And you know, every one of us in our everyday life have struggles of all types, and they're much more important. What it has certainly done that I was taken by surprise about was the whole issue of the border, because knowing it as a hard security border that it was, and it'll never be that, but knowing what it was and then knowing what it became, it just was a change in the road signs, pretty much. And then Brexit, it started to challenge how unionists in Northern Ireland saw themselves. Is this the point at which they're going to be cut off by a border in the ABC? It saw a situation where people in the nationalist community thought, well, we're going to be pulled out of the EU, which has been really, really good to be in. So maybe this is a time to start looking for United Ireland. Now, the thing about all of that is, you know, you could logically argue why there should be United Ireland. You could logically argue why Northern Ireland should remain part of the UK. But logic doesn't have a great place whenever it gets into the emotion of United Ireland and the United Kingdom. And the risk is that people with less than the best interests of the people of the island start campaigning for United Ireland before people are ready for it. Some defence of the union when no one really wants that either. The problem with that is that if a genie gets out of the box, I'm not saying it's going to be like the genie that got out of the box in 1969, but unless we're very vigilant and realise that this has to be at a slow, it's done, it's agreed, and the British people did it, and that's democracy, and there that is. But we need to really, really, really bear in mind that that this has to go so slow, because whenever you stop and you think about the troubles in Northern Ireland, like, you know, every day for 30 years, I mean, 30 years of conflict, and most wars don't last that long. Some of them are a lot bigger, but they're not there every single day for a full 30 years. And then you start challenging the reasons why people had made decisions that they made to defend the union or to look for United Ireland. You then find yourself in a situation where we can cause ourselves an awful lot of trouble unless we go so terribly, terribly slowly and say to ourselves, you know what? What's really important on this island is that we work together, where we have our friendships together, we play sport together, we walk together, we talk together, and the united part, let that get there in its own time.
Future plans for the AFA, given the pandemic, given post-Brexit, has the AFA had to change its tact or change its direction?
The pandemic, which we really didn't expect would have anything to do with peace building, had the outcome that we're all aware of, that people were locked down, and all of the issues around health that arose out of those are there. What we found was that people who wouldn't speak to each other were now speaking to each other. They were now helping each other out. So there's lots of very, very worthwhile stuff that's come out. So we're now making sure that those relationships, which are kind of fast track to a good place, that they stay. We wouldn't have expected to be doing that kind of work. We've always found that because of the trauma of the 30 years that we've talked about, that there were various types of mental health issues, lots of violence that went beyond anything that anyone could ever have expected. We knew we were dealing with a little bit of that. We're now pretty clear that the pandemic has caused an awful lot of isolation, an awful lot of mental health issues, an awful lot of difficulties for young people in particular. So we're going to have a very serious focus on young people because of the pandemic. Also, the North-South thing in the pandemic came out that people in the Republic of Ireland started to say how much better we were than the British, and how we need to stay away from Northern Ireland and the Northern Irish. The Northerners are coming out here, and as time goes on, that's flipping and flopping. It's hard to see from any one day who's in a better place than the other. But we did draw lines of nationalist lines that we shouldn't have drawn. Whereas we were blaming Northern Irish people for coming into Donegal, the people in Saban were blaming Donegal people for going into Asda, and you saw that these are things that were gone. We passed all of that, but that's back. So we're going to have to address how do we calm that down. In terms of Brexit, while we have no direct involvement in Brexit, what happens in Brexit has a big, big effect on what we do is that the basis on which we work is that the relationships between the communities in Northern Ireland are good, that the relationships between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland are good, and the relationships between the Republic of Ireland and Great Britain are good. When the relationships between the Republic of Ireland and Great Britain start to backtrack, and they have, that's obvious that they have, that then sets a tone for how we work. So we've had to up our game in terms of reassuring people in even in border communities that would see themselves as being one community or the other, that we're going to do our best to make sure that what's happening in the border on either side doesn't change. And we've designed a new program to do that in particular. To say, look, the tensions that could arise on the border, that we work very hard to make sure that doesn't happen. And that's not only is that a response that you might expect me to have because I'm from here, but that's the concern that they have in the US, that's a concern that they have in London, that's a concern obviously they have in Dublin and Belfast, to make sure all of that hard work that community heroes delivered over 30 years isn't lost simply because people didn't pay attention to it.
You mentioned the US, obviously along with the European Union, Australia, Canada and New Zealand, one of the fund's main contributors. I'm sure you're keeping more than a passing eye on what's happening across the water in the US.
Yes, firstly the US has been a major player. They've been the most significant funder. And that goes without saying that's important. However, whenever you see the international dimension appearing, then you realise that communities get great motivation from that, because it's not the British or Irish government come and have to talk to them, have to watch them. There's someone far away in another country as powerful as the United States who believes in them, and that's a big plus. Same with the EU, same with Canada, New Zealand and Australia. We always keep a coast watch. The thing about the International Fund is that when it was set up, from this part of the world with John Hume, but in the United States by a Democratic Speaker of the House and a Republican President. Now, the International Fund has got support right across the party process in the North, in the United States. I mean, it's worth reflecting on the nature of the relationship between the Democratic Speaker of the House in the U.S. at the moment and the Republican President. So, while we look at it closely to see what's happening, we work with both the Republican Party and the Democratic Party a lot. In fact, the envoy, Mick Mulvaney, is from a Republican tradition. He was the chief of staff in the White House, and he invited us to the West Wing, which is the working end of the White House, to talk about the fund and to talk about Ireland, to talk about the border. So we're very well viewed on in the States in terms of how we influence what happens here, and they are very keen to work with us, and they're very keen to fund us, they're very keen to up their funding, and we're just in that phase with them at the moment. We're hoping that Special Envoy Mick Mulvaney, when he can, will come, and as part of his being here, we'll take him around the border and we'll take him to places in Northern Ireland just to give him a feel. But it is a very good feel for Ireland anyway.
Is the one priority that you've set for the AFA over the next, say, six months to a year?
Well, we're just on the verge of a new strategy. So our strategy is four parts to it. Three of them already exist, and that's the Peace Impact Programme, which deals with very, very, very challenged, politically challenged environments in Northern Ireland. Then there's the PYDP, which is the Personal Youth Development Programme. That's to identify young people who are vulnerable to paramilitary and criminal activity. The third one is the Peace Walls, which is a terrible name, but we've renamed it as the Peace Barriers Programme. We've been doing those, the priority is to get the cross-border program in place to make sure that it delivers in the way that we want it to deliver. We know how to do the other three well. We have huge expertise, cross-border expertise, for the on the board and in the staff to deal with the cross-border one. But it's going to be very tricky, very complicated. We haven't designed it very tightly, just because we want to see what happens. But that's the number one priority, is to make sure that the border program gets well embedded and delivers in the way that we've promised the U.S. government, the Irish government, the British government it would deliver.
The late John Hume was a big supporter of the AFA.
He was indeed. It was John Hume, while taking Tip O'Neill, the Speaker, we mentioned earlier, the Speaker of the House of Representatives, to Donegal, to his paternal cottage up outside Buncrana. And on that trip into Derry, noticed, you know, the young people on the streets and lots of throwing stones at armies and riots every now and then out of the blue. And Tip O'Neill says, anything we can do? And John Hume says, well, you could help bring jobs here. And also in that was Paddy Bogside Doherty, another great quiet, not that quiet, but a leader that another hero of a leader in Derry. So John Hume was absolutely incredible in his access to influence in the United States. I mean, just incredible. You have to go there to really get it. You can't believe it until you're there and you realise that he had access to everyone. And you might think, well, so why wouldn't he's a politician? But there are politicians all over the world who you couldn't get in a mail of the White House.
What made John Hume different in your age?
John, he was a very astute politician. That goes without saying. John had a set of beliefs that made it possible for him to stay solid on a non-violent solution. And he had a vision, which is really hard to do in the depths of the Troubles, that saw way beyond the now, way beyond what we were going to do about the violence now. It was like he was looking down a tunnel, and at the very end of the tunnel, he could see this outcome, this peaceful outcome, when most other people could only managed to get past today. It was so bad. So that's an incredible skill to have. And then he had this ability to just light up whenever it mattered. And he didn't have any complicated stories. He said the same thing. I know people talk about Hume speak, and they sort of think, well, you know, that was a very easy thing. John Hume knew that in the noise of the world, Northern Ireland isn't, nor is Ireland that big, but so all he had to do is keep saying it, not a different message, keep saying the same thing, and he would eventually get over the noise, and he did. And also he took risks, and at the time of some of the risks he was taking, I was saying, oh, I don't know if this is a good idea, but then I couldn't see what John Hume could see.
He enjoyed a very good relationship too with your late father, Paddy.
He did, Kieran. Going back a very, very long time, I think they probably, maybe in the 60s, they would have spoken more about politics and about the SDLP and all that sort of stuff. And then whenever 1969 appeared, my father got involved as well. And himself and John Hume were fellow travellers and all of that. And people would arrive in our, myself and brother Jimmy, in our bedroom was a camp bed. And on some Sunday mornings, there would be somebody on the camp bed, and we wouldn't know who it was. And then when my father would eventually have our various rows with my father, because he was bringing people who had paramilitary backgrounds on their way to somewhere. And as far as we were concerned, these were people who were killing people, and we didn't want them in our bedroom. I now understand why he did it, because if you want people to take another path, then you have to start from the very beginning where they're at, figure out why they're doing this way and not using another way, and then introduce them to their counterpart, for want of a better word, to find out that the issues they have are the same, more or less, their life issues, And that's probably what gave me the passion for doing what I'm doing. I now know that peace building and creating a shared society is something that's, in one way, very simple, because I saw my father do it, but it requires an enormous amount of patience, an enormous amount of skill, and a passion for wanting to do it. So that's I got that from I think I picked that up from my father amidst all the rows me and Jimmy used to have with him.
Finally, Paddy, is there one legacy that you'd like to leave when you finish your tenure as chairman of the International Fund for Ireland?
I think I would like young people. I would like young people to understand that the immediacy of using violence as a way of resolving conflict only looks good for a very short time. And it's only when they would look back on it a lot later that they'd realise it was the wrong thing. I would like them to know that their first option is always a peaceful option. It takes a lot longer, but it's like the old Irish saying, the longest route out is often the shortest road home.
And a peaceful society means a more vibrant and a more successfully economic society.
Yes, I had this discussion with the Secretary of State, Brandon Lewis, who comes from an economic background, and Kent, so do I, and we're saying, look, the reason why Northern Ireland jumpstarts with all the talent it has, its positioning, where it is, its resources, that it keeps starting in terms of its economic vibrancy. And we know in Donegal, when the troubles were at their height, no one came to Donegal. So in order to have a vibrant business community, then you have to have a peaceful society. And maybe that's another thing that is becoming to the fore because of the pandemic, that the business community has stepped into the community much more. Lots of them did, but much more than they ever did. And the same step into supporting peace is the next move that the business community need to realise what you just said, Kieran. That to have a vibrant business community, you need to have a peaceful society.
Paddy Hart, Chairman of AFA, thanks for joining us on Business Matters.
Thanks, Kieran.
That's it for another edition of Business Matters. I'd like to thank my guest, Paddy Hart. I'd like to thank you for listening. And if you'd like to get in touch with the show, send me an email to businessmatters@highlandradio.com.